Get them. When the Americans appeared, rough, rugged, good-looking veterans of the whaling grounds, she announced in English, "The law, me, I give you. More better you think so, too." "Ma'am," one of the captains interrupted, "we've been coming to Lahaina for a dozen years. We always had a good time here and behaved ourselves pretty well. I can't say what's going to happen now."
"I can say," Malama cried in Hawaiian, "you are going to obey the laws."
"Our men got to have women," the captain protested.
"Do you riot in the streets of Boston?" Malama demanded.
"For women, yes," the captain replied.
"And the police stop you, is that not right?" Malama pressed.
The captain wagged his forefinger and threatened, "Ma'am, no police on this pitiful island better try to stop my men."
"Our police will stop you," Malama warned.
Then she changed her tone and pleaded with the captains. "We are a small country, trying to grow up in the modern world. We have got to change our ways. It is not right that our girls should swim out to the ships. You know that. You have got to help us."
"Ma'am," one of the captains growled stubbornly, "there's going to be trouble."
"Then there will be trouble," Malama said softly, and sent the captains away. Kilolo wanted to back down. Keoki was afraid there would be serious rioting, and Noelani counseled caution. But Malama was obdurate. She sent messengers to summon all the biggest men from the outward areas. She went in person to the new fort to see if its gates were strong, and she told Kilolo, "Tonight you must be ready to fight. The captains are right. There is going to be trouble." But when her people had gone about their tasks, and when they could not spy upon her, she summoned Abner and asked him directly, "Are we doing the right thing?"
"You are," he assured her.
"And there will be trouble tonight?"
"Very bad trouble, I am afraid," he admitted.
"Then how can we be doing the right thing?" she pressed. He told her of a dozen incidents in the Old Testament wherein men faced great adversaries in defense of God's way. And when he was through, he asked her in a low voice, "Malama, do you not know in your heart that the laws you read were good?"
"They are part of my heart," she replied cryptically.
"Then they will prevail," Abner assured her. Malama wanted to believe, but the cowardice of her other advisors had infected her. So now she towered above Abner, stared down at him and said, "Little Mikaneli," using the Hawaiian pronunciation of missionary, "tell me the truth. Are we doing the right thing?"
Abner closed his eyes, raised his head toward the grass roof, and cried in the voice that Ezekiel must have used when addressing the Jewish elders, "The islands of Hawaii will live under these laws, for they are the will of the Lord God Jehovah."
Assured, Malama turned to other matters and asked, "What will happen tonight?"
"They won't bother you, Malama, but I think they may try to burn my house. Can Jerusha and the children stay with you?"
"Of course, and you too."
"I'll be in the house," he said simply. And as he limped away, Malama loved her stubborn little Mikaneli.
That night, the streets of Lahaina were a shambles. At dusk, a drunken sea captain, in conjunction with Murphy, led a group of men to the fort and dared the policemen there to blow the conch shell. When the warning to sailors sounded, the mob grabbed every policeman in sight and threw them into the bay. Then they stormed back to Murphy's, where Pupali's three oldest daughters were dancing in the nude to wild shrieks of joy. As bottles were passed, sailors shouted, "Drink up! When this is done, the missionary says we can't have no more." The reiteration of this cry so maddened the mob that someone shouted, "Let's have done with that little pisser for all time." And they stormed into the street, heading for the mission house. But on the way, someone proposed a better plan. "Why bother with him? Why not burn his goddamned church? It's made of grass." And four men scurried through the night with torches,
pitching them high onto the grass roofing. Soon the night breezes had whipped the flames across the top of the structure and had started them down the sides. The great beacon thus lighted had consequences that the rioters had not foreseen, for the people who had worked upon this church had grown to love it as a symbol of their town, and now that it was ablaze, they rushed to save it. Quickly, the area around the church was filled with sweating, silent, urgent men and women who beat at the walls to keep them from going up in flames. And by the incredible labors they performed that night, they saved more than half the walls, drenching them with water and beating at them with brooms and bare hands. The sailors, aghast at the bravery with which these illiterate islanders worked, withdrew and watched in wonder. But when the people of Lahaina saw how little was left of their beloved church, where words of great hope had been preached to them, they became furious to the point of hysteria, and an islander cried, "Let us throw the sailors into jail." The firefighters greeted his challenge with cheers, and a wild manhunt was launched. Wherever a sailor was spotted, three or four big natives crashed down upon him, often leaving him unconscious under some heavy woman who sat on him, banging his head while her men went off in search of others. Bosuns, captains, common sailors were treated alike, and any who resisted had their arms or jaws broken. When the assault was over, Kelolo sent official policemen around, searching for bodies which he pitched into the new jail. Then, with the foresight of a politician, he went personally among the piles of Americans and searched out all the captains, saying to each in his most fatherly voice, "Capitani, I sorry inside me. We no see good, we think you crew, we boom boom good too much. No pelikia, I take care of you." And he took them to Murphy's and bought each man a drink. But as they pressed their broken lips to the glass, he was pleased to see how badly scarred they were. At the next dusk, the conchs sounded, and a good many sailors climbed into boats and returned to their ships. Those that didn't were chased through the town, not by policemen, but by infuriated gangs of Hawaiians bent on thrashing them. But whenever a sailor was caught, some policeman was ready to rescue him, and by 8 o'clock the jail was full. On the third night, most of the sailors who were caught ashore after curfew sought out the police, to whom they willingly gave themselves up, preferring that to the coursing mobs. And by the fourth night, order was restored in Lahaina. Kelolo's police were in command. On the next day, Malama, at Kelolo's suggestion, summoned the whaling captains to her grass palace where a feast had been spread. She greeted each bruised skipper with personal warmth and commiserated with him over the rude behavior of her people. She fed the captains well, offered them fine whiskey, and then proposed, "Our lovely church is burned. It was an accident, I am sure. Naturally, we want to rebuild it, and we will. But before we do, we want to do something for the fine Americans who come to Lahaina. Therefore, we are going to build a little chapel for sailors. It will give them a place to read and pray and write letters home to their dear ones. Will you kind men set the example and give a few dollars for the chapel?" And by her daring charm, she wheedled more than $60 from the astonished captains, and another of Abner Hale's dreams, one that he had entertained since that day off the Four Evangelists, when the sailors went swinging through the arcs of heaven, was realized. The Seaman's Chapel at Lahaina. By 1828, it seemed that Abner's world was at last beginning to be well organized. He had a rude desk and a whale oil lamp by which he translated the Bible. He had three schools functioning with increasing success, and the day seemed not too far distant when Iliki, Pupali's youngest and loveliest daughter, would be married in church to one or the other of the established Hawaiian men who were trying, with increasing regularity, to peek into Jerusha's school. Captain Janders returned to Lahaina and his announced decision to settle down as a ship chandler, with his wife and children coming out from New Bedford. gave Abner a polished mind with whom he could conduct discussions. While the captain's happy knowledge that young Cridland, the devout sailor from the Thetis, was footloose in Honolulu, where the ship's company had been disbanded, encouraged Abner to direct a letter to the youth, asking him to throw in his lot with the seaman's chapel, so that Cridland was now employed there, giving guidance to the younger sailors who arrived in Lahaina on the rapidly increasing whaling fleet. 45 whalers in 1828, 62 in 1829. Malama was rapidly approaching a state of grace, so that it seemed assured that she would be accepted into the rebuilt church when it was dedicated. And there were really only two difficulties looming on the broad and lovely horizon at Lahaina. Abner had anticipated the first, for when it came time to rebuild the church, Kilolo announced that the kahunas wished to consult with Abner again. But he replied, "The door will stay where it was. All this talk in the community that the kahunas knew the church would be destroyed irritates me. Some drunken sailors burned it, and that's that. Your local superstitions had nothing whatever to do with it."
"Makuahale," Kilolo protested gently. "We did not wish to speak about the door. We know your mind is made up, and we know that your church will always be unlucky, but there is nothing we can do about that."
"What did the kahunas want to see me about?" Abner asked suspiciously.
"Come to the church," Kilolo begged.
And when Abner met with the wise old men, they pointed to the 2/3 walls and the absent ceiling and made this proposal.
"Makuahale, it has occurred to us that the last church was very hot indeed, what with more than 3,000 people huddled on the floor and no wind to cool them off."
"It was warm," Abner agreed.
"Would it not, therefore, be a wise thing if we did not build the destroyed walls any higher? Would it not be better indeed if we could pull them down even farther? Then we could erect high posts and raise the ceiling as it was before, so that when the church is finished, the winds will move across us and cool us as if we were on the shore."
It took some minutes for Abner to comprehend this radical suggestion, and he tried to piece its various components together in his mind.
"You mean, tear the present walls down to here?"
"Even lower, Makuahale," the kahunas advised.
"Well," Abner reflected, "then raise the pillars as before?"
"Yes, and hang the ceiling from them as before."
"But you wouldn't have any walls," Abner protested.
"The wind would move over us, and that would be better," the wise men explained.
"But there would be no walls. A man sitting here," and he squatted on the ground, "could look up and watch the sky."
"Would that be wrong?" Kilolo asked.
"But a church always has walls," Abner replied slowly. He thought of every church he had ever seen in New England. The very essence of a church was that it have four rugged, square walls and a steeple above them. Even the pictures he had seen of churches in foreign lands showed four walls, and those that did not were clearly popish. So he said firmly, "We will build the church as before."
"It will be very hot," Kilolo warned.
"A church must have walls," Abner said, and he left the wondering kahunas.
The second difficulty could not have been foreseen, at least not by Abner Hale. It concerned Keoke Kanakoa, whose school was accomplishing wonders in bringing Hawaiian boys from the Stone Age into the present. Half the sailors aboard the Thetis, as it plied from Lahaina to Honolulu on weekly trips, were young men trained by Keoke. The boys who worked at the mission printing press, publishing the Bible, were his boys, too. In community life, he was a rugged, dependable tower of Christian strength, and his Bible readings in formal services were inspiring. It should not have been surprising, therefore, but it was, when Keoki appeared in Abner's grass house one day and asked, "Reverend Hale, when can I hope to be ordained a full minister?" Abner rested his pen and looked at the young man in astonishment.
"A minister?" he gasped.
"Yes, I was told at Yale that I must return to Hawaii and become a minister to my people,"
But you already work with them, Keoki, Abner explained.
I believe I am ready to have a church of my own, Keoki suggested, in some new part of the island where the people need God.
But there can't be a church without a missionary, Keoki.
Why not? The handsome Hawaiian asked.
Well, Abner began. He threw down the pen. I have no plans for ordaining Hawaiians, he said bluntly.
Why not? Keoki pressed.
Well, it's never even been considered, Keoki, Abner explained.
You do excellent work in the school,
of course,
but a full-fledged minister?
Oh, no, that would be ridiculous. Impossible.
But I thought you missionaries came here to educate us, to get us ready to take care of ourselves.
We did, Keoki, Abner assured him. You have heard me talk with your mother. I insist that she govern every aspect of the island. I touch nothing.
You have been fine about that, Keoki acknowledged. But the church is more important than the government.
Exactly, Abner jumped. The government could fail because of your mother's errors, and that would be no irremediable harm. But if the church failed because of your error, well, Keoki, the damage could never be repaired.
But how will you know whether I am strong enough to do God's work unless you test me? Keoki pleaded.
With the life of the church at stake, Keoki, we can take no chances.
Does that mean that I can never become a minister here in my own land?
Gravely, Abner leaned back in his chair and thought, somebody better tell him the facts. So he said coldly,
would you have the strength, Keoki, to discipline your fellow Hawaiians as God requires? Would you seek out those who lead a lewd life and announce their names on Sunday, and track down those who drink? Would you dare to expel the ali'i who smokes? Could I trust you to use the right words in explaining the Bible, or to refuse bribes when the ali'i want to join the church?
Keoki, my dear son, you will never have the courage to be a true minister. For one thing, you are too young.
I am older than you were when you became a minister, the Hawaiian pointed out.
Yes, but I grew up in a Christian family. I was...
A white man? Keoki asked bluntly.
Yes, Abner replied with equal frankness.
Yes, Keoki, my ancestors fought for this church for 100 years. From the day I was born, I knew what a heavenly thing, what an inspired divine thing the church was. You don't know yet, and we can't trust the church in your hands.
You are saying very bitter things, Reverend Hale, Keoki replied.
Do you remember aboard the Thetis when I gave the old whaler in the forecastle the Bible and how he brought ridicule on the Bible and on me and on God? That's what happens when we risk the welfare of the church in the wrong hands. You must wait, Keoki, until you have proved yourself.
I have proved myself, Keoki said stubbornly. I proved myself at Yale College when I stood in the snow begging an education. I proved myself at Cornwall, where I was the top student in the mission school. And here in Lahaina, I have protected you against the sailors. What more must I do to prove myself?
Those acts were your duty, Keoki. They qualified you for church membership. But to qualify for the ministry itself...
Perhaps when you are an old, tested man, not now. And he dismissed the arrogant young man.
He was rather startled when, in discussing these matters with Jerusha, she sided with Keoki, arguing,
"Your commission, Abner, from the American board that sent you here, was to train up the Hawaiians so that they could organize and run their own churches."
"Organize them and run them, yes," Abner instantly agreed.
"Soon we will take in more members and institute a board of deacons. But to make a Hawaiian a minister? Jerusha, it would be complete folly."
I couldn't tell poor Keoki, but he will never become a minister. Never.
Why not? Jerusha asked.
He's a heathen. He's no more civilized than Pupali's daughters. One good hurricane and he would lose all his veneer of civilization.
But when we are gone, Abner, we shall have to turn the church over to Keoki and his fellows. We shall never go, Abner said with great solemnity. This is our home, our church.
You mean to stay here forever? Jerusha asked.
Yes. And when we die, the board in Boston will send out others to take our places. Keoki running a church? Impossible. But Abner had acquired the habit of listening to his wife, and long after their discussion ended, he brooded about what she had said. And at last he found a reasonable solution to the impasse over Keoki, and he summoned the young Hawaiian.
Keoki, he announced happily, I have discovered a way whereby you can serve the church as you desire.
You mean I can be ordained? The young man cried joyfully.
Not exactly, Abner replied. And he was so preoccupied with his satisfactory answer to Keoki's problem that he failed to observe how disappointed the latter was.
What I'm willing to do, Keoki, is to make you the Luna of the church, the top deacon. You move among the Hawaiians and find out who is smoking. You check to see who has alcohol on his breath. Each week, you hand me a list of people to be admonished from the pulpit, and you draw up the names of those to be expelled from the church. At night, you will creep quietly through Lahaina to let me know who is sleeping with another man's wife. I am willing to have you do these things for the church, Abner concluded happily. How do you like that?
Keoki stood silent, staring at the little missionary. And when the latter asked again for his response, Keoki said bitterly, I sought a way to serve my people, not to spy upon them. And he stalked from the mission, remaining in seclusion for many days. If Jerusha and Keoki could not stand up to Abner's arguments against the Hawaiians, a visitor was about to descend on Lahaina who not only marshaled all of Jerusha's doubts and expressed them in vigorous English, but who also brought along many of his own. It was Dr. Whipple, lean and brown from years of work on distant outposts, who came in one day on Kelolo's ship, the Thetis. He hurried immediately to the mission house and shouted, Sister Jerusha, forgive me for not being